You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/bcp.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Brookings Institution. My name is Douglas Paul. I'm from next door at Carnegie Endowment, and Richard Bush, the host of today's event, has been kind enough to ask me to co-host with him out of deference to our mutual friendship with President Ma, your speaker today. Very glad to have you here. Welcome, friends from the media as well. My friendship started more than 30 years ago with President Ma, and when he was a rising star and a handsome Hollywood type from the Justice Ministry in Taipei, and Taipei was on a roll in the world, democratizing, modernizing, growing fast economically. And he's taken off with Taiwan over the years. I got to know him even more when I served in Taipei as U.S. representative to the American Institute in Taiwan. And he was a very effective mayor of Taipei City, brought a lot of change there. But I think by way of introduction today, I'm not going to go through all these experiences. I'd make a few points, mostly an international audience. I think President Ma can look back on a very challenging but also very successful period in managing the big relationships between Taiwan, its neighbors, and its most important partners. On the question of the biggest challenge facing Taiwan, he presided over a rationalization of cross-strait relations to go from mutual non-recognition to mutual non-denial, as he put it himself. And in the course of his time in office, 23 agreements were reached for practical cooperation across the Taiwan Strait. I think the number was 870 flights a week were approved for people to have direct communications between Taiwan and the mainland. Huge explosion of opportunity, business and other cultural exchanges. And that record showed he could handle those big challenges. But we also have to manage the relationship with his most consequential partner, and that's the United States. Japan comes in behind that. And he managed that with great effectiveness. In contrast with his predecessor, he established a climate of trust, a trust that was manifested in the degree to which the United States and Taiwan were able to agree on more and more generous transits of the United States on the way to visit friends and partners overseas for him as the leader of the Republic of China on Taiwan. And then finally, he kept Taiwan very active in the international community. Taiwan was a regular participant as an observer at the World Health Assembly and other institutions that were developed in the time he was in office. So here's a person who comes with a tremendous record internationally as well as a leader at home. And it's my great privilege to welcome my good friend and someone I hope all of you will join me in giving a great welcome to, please.
Director Bush of Brookings Institution, Vice Chairman Paul of Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, Ambassadors Shen, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Exactly 11 years ago, this month, at this institution, I spoke as mayor of Taipei and the chairman of the KMT. I remember telling the audience that the two sides of Taiwan Strait haven't had a cold confrontation for 6 years. Should go back simultaneously to the 1992 consensus in order to have peace in Taiwan Strait. This was exactly what I pursued for in 2008 when I took office as president. But at the time I was here, I had not decided to run for president yet. Exactly 9 years ago, also in this month, I was elected the 12th President of the Republic of China. President George Bush Jr. sent me a congratulating message on the election day, March 22nd. He said, Taiwan is a beacon of democracy to Asia and the world. It was indeed encouraging to everyone in Taiwan. So in my inaugural address, delivered on May 20th, 2008, my blueprint for Taiwan is to build a free, just, and prosperous society, and to build a peaceful Taiwan Strait and a friendly international environment. Barely 4 months into my presidency in September 2008, we, like every country else, were badly struck by the financial tsunami, the worst in 50 years. We soon announced a crisis management package that gave all bank deposit full guarantee, launched a $16 billion US dollars of infrastructure construction plans to stimulate investment, and issued a $120 shopping voucher to every citizen of the Republic of China, to help increase domestic consumption. Well, the first two are good for sure, but the vouchers were so popular that 92% of the people got their shopping voucher on the first day of distribution, January 18, 2009. Many people I met in the street grabbed my hand and said, "Mr. President, please do it again." Others said, "Once more is not enough. Better three times a year." Well, the police were thrilled to be able to identify and arrest more than 40 wanted fugitives waiting in line to get a voucher. Well, these people can keep the voucher for sure, but I mean, they might have to spend it in jail. The impact of this package was strong and immediate, although as far as the people are concerned, the social effect were actually clearly outweighed the economic effect. But the most important thing is, during that period, there was no bankruptcies, no bank runs, no serious unemployment, and no panic. The economy bounced back less than a year later, reaching 10.6% growth, ranking highest in 24 years in Taiwan, and number four in the world. During the 8 years of my presidency, we have tried very hard to improve the economy. But other than the tsunami in 2008, we had a European debt crisis 3 years later. We also had a global export slowdown. Then altogether, the whole world reached a economic growth of 2.2% by average. Our growth rate by average was 2.8 to 2.9 in that 8 years. And our per capita GDP was 47,790 dollars in PPP terms, the purchasing power parity. And so that was in 1916. And we were ahead of the UK, France, Italy, Denmark, Canada, Japan, Korea, but we are behind Hong Kong and Singapore. But it's very important that we tried so hard. We wasn't able to do better, but at least we have tried our best. This is something relatively under our control, but our relation with the mainland is something else. After all, we were already a civil war rival for more than 60 years by then, and ruling a land mass of 265 times and a huge population 58 times of the respective size of Taiwan is not an easy thing. So let me start with some thoughts about the recent development in Taiwan. President-elect Donald Trump surprised the world on December 2nd last year by answering an unprecedented telephone call from our president, Tsai Ing-wen, congratulating him for his election victory. The move was the first of its kind in ever since the United States switched recognition from Taiwan to the Chinese mainland in 1979. However, the strong reaction from Beijing made the media euphoria in Taiwan soon subside and was replaced by sober concern about Taiwan being treated as a bargaining chip in mainland China's future negotiations with the United States. On the other hand, Mr. Trump complained about the One China principle and why the U.S. has to abide by that, particularly when the media criticized him for trampling on the red line. President Obama, worrying about the consequences of this development, came out to hold a press conference before his departure at the White House on December 17, emphasizing the importance of One China principle as a cornerstone of U.S.-China relations. In the evening on February the 9th, 2017, President Trump called President Xi Jinping of mainland China, and 20 days after his inauguration, agreeing at the request of President Xi, I agreed to honor our China policy, ending the speculation that President Trump might change it. As you all know, the One China principle has been the cornerstone of U.S.-China policy ever since 1972. So in 45 years, 8 presidents, 12 terms, this principle has been the basis of the relations between Washington and Beijing. So once changed, the impact on U.S.-China relations would have been enormous. Now, President Trump now went back to the longstanding China policy of the U.S., showing that pragmatism continues to be the key consideration after all. Well, let me take a look at the One China principle as practiced in the international community. There are 196 nation states in the world, the People's Republic of China, PRC, currently maintains diplomatic ties with 173 of them, with which all but 36 states sign joint communiques when they establish diplomatic ties with mainland China. This 137 joint communiques are very interesting to look at. They focus on two things. First of all, recognizing mainland China represent the whole of China. Number two, the PRC's claim on Taiwan's sovereignty. So by and large, the 130 states which signed the joint communique recognize the PRC is the only legitimate government of China. But on Taiwan's sovereignty, they have been 3 categories of statement. The first category of 52 states recognized the PRC's sovereignty over Taiwan by stating that Taiwan is a province or a part of the territories of the PRC. These countries include Portugal, South Africa, and Israel. The second category has 29 states. These 29 states are relatively probably more important than the other states. They use relatively vague language to express their attitude toward PRC's claim to Taiwan. For instance, the United States use acknowledge. Japan use understand and respect. And Canada use take note of. So you can see they use this in order to either be flexible or have some reservations about the PRC's claim. So President Trump on February 9 used honor. Well, I think that is very similar to an acknowledge or respect. Basically, it's different from some, but by and large belong to the category of vague usage. The third category has 56 states, which did not even mention Taiwan in their joint communiques. These countries include Germany, Ireland, and Mexico. So, in sum, other than the 52 states that explicitly recognized the PRC's claim to Taiwan, the other 85 states did not. If we add the 36 states that did not even sign a joint communique with the PRC, the total number will reach 121. That means 70% of all the joint communiques actually did not say anything or say some vague things. So it is obvious that the 121 states prefer to keep some flexibility and reservation as regards the PRC's claim to Taiwan. Well, take the United States, for example. The U.S. has three joint communiques. One is 1972 Shanghai communique. The second is 1979, the joint communique for establishing diplomatic ties. And number three, the 1982, the August 17 communique dealing with arms sales to Taiwan. So you can see that the three communiques could be seen as one China policy, but Taiwan Relations Act could mean flexibility and reservation. Well, I'm sure you understand in the Taiwan Relations Act, it says, for the purpose of American law and American court, Taiwan is considered as a foreign state or government. I remember when all this happened, I was studying law at Harvard Law School. One day, I came across one of my thesis advisor, Professor Vox. He said, "Angel, I understand how you feel these days. But you have to understand, Taiwan is the most recognized, unrecognized government of the United States." And there was another article appearing in a law journal saying that while the U.S. de-recognized Taiwan, the Taiwan Relations Act re-recognized Taiwan, which is in some way is true. Well, when you look at the language of the Taiwan Relations Act, he says he didn't really specify the change is a severance of diplomatic relations or withdrawal of recognition. As you know, these are entirely two different things. But the language of the law says withdrawal of recognition or severance of diplomatic relations. Obviously, the lawmakers didn't even know how to define that new relationship. Now, let's take a look at the One China principle or One China policy in cross-strait relations. Well, it all started with Jiang Jingguo when he decided on November 1987 to let residents of Taiwan to go to the mainland China for family reunion. A few years later, the mainland side says, "Why don't we talk about the meaning of One China or One China principle?" And the then president of the Republic of China, President Li Denghui, decided to convene a National Unification Council to discuss the meaning. Eventually, the result came out as this. The two sides of Taiwan Strait insist on the One China principle, but the meaning they assign to it differ. The Chinese Communist Authority considers One China as the People's Republic of China, while our side regards One China as the Republic of China established since 1912. Taiwan is part of China. So is the Chinese mainland. So this is the language accepted, adopted by our side. So on the basis of this resolution, our Strait Exchange Foundation 海峡交流基金会 SEF and Mainland China's Association for Relations Across the Taiwan Strait 海峡两岸关系协会 These two foundations or organizations represent respectively Taiwan and Mainland China. They met in Hong Kong in late October 1992, but they didn't reach any consensus initially, so they went home. A few days later, the SEF took initiative to send another proposal on November the 3rd, stating that in the process of striving toward national unification, the two sides insist on the One China principle, but they differ on its definition. They could express their interpretations by oral statement, respectively. So on November the 16th, about 2 weeks later, ARAS, 海协会, replied by fax, saying that it fully respects and accept the new proposal. So on the following day, all the media in Taiwan started calling the consensus One China respective interpretations, 一中各表, 一个中国各自表述, which was later called 92 consensus. In April 1993, the SEF and ARAT, on the basis of the 92 consensus, successfully arranged the unprecedented talk between Gu Zhenfu, chairman of the SEF, and Wang Daohan, director of ARAT in Singapore, signing four agreements as a result. But they failed to solve other problems that occurred later. So after President Chen Shui-bian took office in the year 2000, he initiated the one country on each side of the Taiwan Strait concept in his second term. He didn't do it in the first term, but in the second term, and pushed for a referendum of Taiwan's entry into the United Nations. For those of you who may not know, even today in the United Nations, in the Charter Article 23 and Article 110, the name Republic of China is still there. It was not changed. And so the question is, if Taiwan want to join the United Nations, then the question is, in what capacity? Are you applying as a new member, or you want to restore your original status? So, but then President Chen took the first approach. The move was considered by mainland China and United States as a provocative move toward Taiwan independence. Because if we apply as a new member, in case it was accepted, of course it's not possible, but that could mean independence. So, ever since then, mainland China cut off all contact with Taiwan. Consultations, negotiations between the two organizations all cut off. It was wholly suspended in 1998 and not resumed until May 20, when I was inaugurated. But early on March 26, 4 days after I was elected president, President George Bush Jr. and mainland China's president, Hu Jintao, had a telephone call. There, Hu Jintao says, "It is China's consistent stand that the Chinese mainland and Taiwan should restore consultation and talks on the basis of 1992 consensus." If I remember correctly, this is the first time a mainland Chinese paramount leader says 92 consensus. He said, "The 92 consensus, which sees both sides recognize there's only one China, but agree to defer on its definition." Look how similar the language it is compared to Li Denghui's language. I was stunned. When I read the newspaper, I couldn't believe my eyes. A mainland China leader could have gone that far. So his remarks almost coincide fully with 92 consensus referred to above. I immediately decided to send Dr. Su Qi, the Secretary General Designate of the National Security Council, to accompany Vice President-elect Vincent Xu to the Boao Forum in Hainan Province in April. There they met with President Hu Jintao and expressed our side's intention to restore the interrupted talks with them on the basis of the 1992 consensus. Well, Hu Jintao responded positively to the message and stated four continuations regarding travel, cooperation, consultation, and protection of interests. So in my inaugural address, now, this is all clear. So in my inaugural address, I said it very clearly that I will maintain Taiwan, maintain Taiwan's Strait status quo of no unification, no independence, and no use of force, and under the framework of the Republic of China Constitution, and conduct the peaceful development of cross-strait relations on the basis of the 1992 consensus. I later explained to the outside world that no unification means no unification talks during my term of office. And because the differences are so great that it would take a long time to resolve them. And no independence means no support for Taiwan's independence because there's no such need and it is not going to succeed. So no use of force is self-explanatory. In the following 8 years, Taiwan has greatly expanded the cross-strait relations by concluding 23 agreements with the mainland, covering a wide range of subjects. For instance, the direct scheduled flight, there was none in 2008, but the number has reached 890 round-trip flights per week in 2015. Actually, they reached 64 points in mainland China and Taiwan. The mainland tourists jumped from less than 300,000 people to 4.1 million. Altogether, it's almost 18 million. And mainland students, they used to be 823 in 2007 and became 42,000 in 2015. So a jump of 50 times. Eventually, I met with Xi Jinping in Singapore. It was a very important meeting. We reaffirmed that 92 consensus is the common political foundation of the two sides. And I also assured them, when we said one China, respective interpretations, our interpretation will not be two Chinas, one China, one Taiwan, or Taiwan's independence. Why? I told them these interpretations will not be permitted under our constitution. And in the meeting, I also questioned their military deployment against Taiwan. Actually, I told them that in one of their military base in Zhuzhihe in Gansu, they built a building very much like my office. And they deployed more than 1,500 missiles against Taiwan. But they say our missiles are not targeted against Taiwan. But in any case, I also told them that when our people want to go to United Nations to take a look, but they are not allowed to use their passport to exchange for the permit to get in. I said, this is really, antagonize a lot of people in Taiwan. So this is a good occasion for us to exchange views. But what is even more important is the two sides' mutual trust in having this meeting. Our team went to the mainland to negotiate with them about the specifics. For instance, neither side will mention the country name. Neither side will mention the name of our position, president or whatever. And we'll call each other just Mr., nothing else. What about meeting place? Originally, I hope we could use the meeting hall, which we used in 1993. But that was out of order, it has to be repaired. So they said, why don't you just use Shangri-La Hotel? They said they have diplomatic relations with Singapore, so they will take care of that in Manila. They will pay for that. Well, I said, if you insist, that's okay. But what about banquet afterwards? Well, we discussed for a while and decided we'll go Dutch. What about beverages? Well, we will bring our own beverages. So the meeting was done with equal footing on almost everything. But in the end, it seems that they consume more Gaoliang than we did for Mao Tai. But in any case, this is an interesting occasion for the two sides to meet. And you can see that there were more than 600 journalists there trying to find out what's going on. And I noticed that one Western magazine says, this is the greatest concession on sovereignty issues on the part of mainland China. But I think my purpose is to build a bridge of peace across the Taiwan Strait, ready to provide access to any leaders of Taiwan or the mainland, as long as they observe the traffic regulations. Quite interesting that after the meeting, we noticed that one Southeast Asian country is not very far from Singapore through their foreign ministry saying that if Taiwan and the mainland China want to do that again, please come to my country. Well, in sum, the 92 consensus is a fundamental political commitment for Taiwan and the mainland accepted by mainland. You know, this is actually what Taiwan asked for. It's not the mainland imposing that on Taiwan. That's a very, very important point. And the language is pretty simple. So a lot of people say the 92 consensus is a masterpiece of ambiguity. Well, ambiguous or not, as long as you work, and you work all right. It should not be unilaterally ignored, changed, or abolished without the approval of the two sides. Otherwise, the mutual trust will be lost, and that could mean very serious to the two sides. What happened in the Taiwan Strait after May 20th last year exactly attests to this observation. Now, we now come to the issue which I'm sure all of you are concerned about, the current stalemate between Taiwan and mainland in cross-strait relations. Well, as you know, the presidential and legislative yuan, the parliamentary elections in January 2016, substantially changed the political landscape in Taiwan. Not only Chairwoman Tsai Ing-wen was elected president with 56% of the votes, but DPP also took more than two-thirds of the seats of our national parliament. Out of all 113 seats, the KMT has only 35. Taiwan is undergoing the third electoral turnover in 16 years. Other than the economy and energy, the challenge in cross-strait relations is the most far-reaching of all. And President Tsai's campaign promise was to maintain the status quo in cross-strait relations, as my administration did in my 8 years of presidency. However, she refuses to accept the 92 consensus, which is the key part of the status quo in cross-strait relations. I actually had reminded her 2 years ago that if without 92 consensus, there could be no status quo, as same as my administration's. So ever since President Tsai took office on May 20th last year, most, if not all, of the official contacts between mainland China and Taiwan was suspended. Just like the period under President Chen Shui-bian, except for a few technical matters. In 2016, the number of mainland tourists dropped 16%, or roughly 700,000. And business tourists dropped 25%, about 200,000. And more than 50 hotels are offered for sale, and 47 travel agencies went out of business. And, well, hundreds of tour buses are either idle or went out of business. The same is true also with gift shops, because unlike the tourists from Japan, United States, Europe, the mainland tourists didn't spend very much on hotel, but their expertise is shopping. And so their purchasing power is the highest compared to any other tourists. And so this makes the gift shops also suffering heavily. I remember 9 years ago when I campaigned for president, the situation is pretty much like today. So when I went to Senmu Lake and promised the people there, if you elect me, I will make an economic boom again. At the time, business people there told me, Mr. Ma, here we take 5 days off a week, not 2 days. And you know, after I took office for 2 years, the business was booming, particularly for the tour boats. Each boat can run 10 times a day. Each will receive 40,000 NT. So they make a lot of money out of that, but the situation is back to when it was 9 years ago. And there are another two things. One is the ECFA, the Economic Cooperation Agreement, Framework Agreement with the mainland, was actually halfway done. For the goods, it's only about 10%, and surface trade agreement was halted. This will hurt Taiwan's long-term future, because 39% of Taiwan's export went to mainland China and Hong Kong. And on December 21st last year, our diplomatic ally, Sao Tome and Principe in West Africa, several diplomatic relations with us, reducing the number of our allies from 22 to 21. 5 days later, it established diplomatic ties with Beijing, and it's not unlikely that we'll lose more allies in the future. Just recently, something might go wrong in St. Lucia in the Caribbean. We're still watching that attentively. On the other hand, this year, many people fear that we won't be able to attend the World Health Assembly in Geneva. And in September, that would be in May. In September, the ICAO, International Civil Aviation Organization meeting in Toronto. And so these are the things that we worry that situation could become worse. Another thing is, beginning in November through December, war planes from the mainland flew over our territorial airspace around Taiwan. On July 11, 2017, the Liaoning ship, mainland China's aircraft carrier, actually sailed through the Taiwan Strait. This is not abnormal, but sometimes people still pay a lot of attention. On January 12, 2017, it was announced that our trade office in Abuja, Nigeria, bearing the full name of Republic of China, was forced to move out of the city with a name change. On February 17, Spain expatriated 218 telecommunication fraud suspects to Chinese mainland for indictment and trial without even notifying Taiwan's Mainland Affairs Council, as they normally did before May 20th last year. So Beijing's move might have something to do with the Trump-Tsai telephone. Mainland China insists that President Tsai has not finished her 1992 exam, so she has to finish that before the relation could be restored. In addition to the negative developments, the mainland's internet citizens have gradually changed their erstwhile friendly attitude toward Taiwan. Even now, they talk about unification by force. The two sides are now in a state of high-risk cold confrontation without three vital things. First of all, mutual trust. Secondly, communication, effective communication, and then buffer. So they are all warning signs that we should not overlook. Now, let's consider what can we do to really break the cross-strait stalemate. We just had a lunch together. Everybody raised that question. I'm trying to see what we can do. Even since President Tsai Ing-wen took office on May 20, 2016, she has repeatedly expressed her goodwill and sincerity in maintaining a stable and peaceful status quo. In doing so, she vowed to abide by the ROC Constitution and the Mainland Relations Act. She called for benign and constructive dialogue and communication with mainland China, yet the mainland side continues to question her inaction to accept the 92 consensus and finish the exam. To break the stalemate, based on our 8-year experience of dealing with mainland China, let's first identify the indispensable policy measures on either side would like the other side to accommodate. Let me show you. First of all, Taiwan would like to have, first of all, attendance at 2017 WHO, World Health Assembly, and ICAO conferences. Second, diplomatic truce in the international community. The two sides stop trying to get the diplomatic ally of the other country. Number three, the number of mainland tourists and students goes up to at least the 2016 level. Fourth, restoration of cross-strait negotiations on the trading goods agreement. Mainland China would like Taiwan to say that, first of all, the peoples across Taiwan Strait are all ethnic Chinese of the Chinese nation. They are 都是 中华民族的一员. Second, the cross-strait relations are not international relations. They are special relations. 两岸关系不是国际关系,是特别的关系. And number three, and finally, acceptance of the 92 consensus. Well, it's clear that rhetoric would not help. So we need concrete actions. Here, I would like to remind you, ladies and gentlemen, at this juncture, it's critical not to forget the teachings of Mencius, Mengzi, 2,300 years ago, regarding the ways and means for the kingdoms to deal with each other. He said this in response to a question by Qi Xuanwang, the king of the Qi kingdom. He said, a large kingdom should deal with a small kingdom with benevolence, and a small kingdom shall deal with a large kingdom with wisdom. 为仁者为能以大事小，为智者能以小事大. By so doing, the king of the large kingdom can safeguard his commonwealth, whereas the king of the small kingdom can safeguard his own kingdom. 就以大事小者保天下，以小事大者。 Applying the wisdom of the Mencius to the current statement, here is my suggestion. To break the ice, given the recent onslaught of H5N6 avian flu, 禽流感, across the Taiwan Strait, it would be nice for mainland China to announce that for humanitarian purposes or humanitarian reasons, it would assist Taiwan to attend the WHA at Geneva in the coming May. This move, as the first step for reconciliation, may lead to friendly responses from the Taiwan side, particularly the Taiwan people. The atmosphere would then change gradually as a result of other measures to follow, if other measures follow. At least the frozen ground will be defrosted somewhat to release a stream of hot air between the two sides of cold front inflicted Taiwan Strait. Other policy measures may be considered at due time as time goes by, hoping to reach a stall eventually. Well, I would conclude my remarks. President Trump's return to the traditional One China policy reflects the state practice in One China principle of more than 70% of the states that have established diplomatic relations with the PRC. They all maintain a flexible attitude and reserved attitude toward the PRC's claim over sovereignty over Taiwan. Therefore, the One China principle they practice is actually One China, respective interpretations. 他们是国际社会所做的，也是一中各表。 By using that, they could enjoy their full diplomatic relations with mainland China, but they could also conduct substantive diplomacy with Taiwan. During my 8-year tenure as president, I have frequently been criticized by the DPP as leaning toward China and betray Taiwan. 亲中卖台. However, accepting the 92 consensus would not abrogate at all the sovereignty or legal status of Taiwan in the international community. Quite to the contrary, it actually enhanced Taiwan's status in improving relations with the US, Japan, New Zealand, Singapore, the rest of ASEAN countries, and the European Union. And the acquiring of visa-free or landing visa status from 164 states and their territories, more than three times the figure, 58, in 2008 and before. You know what? We have done a lot which we cannot accomplish as a result of the 92 consensus. For instance, Mrs. Susan Thornton, the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State of the United States for East Asian and Pacific Affairs, she said publicly in May 2015 that the Taiwan-U.S. relations was the best ever because of, among other things, the stable management of cross-strait relations. So my grand strategy for dealing with mainland China, Japan, and the U.S. at the same time is to enhance Taiwan's national interest and to maintain, first of all, a peaceful relationship with Chinese mainland. 和路, 对, 跟大陆和平, a friendly relations with Japan, 对日本友好, and a cordial relations with the United States, 跟美国亲善. My 8 years as president show that my grand strategy worked well to improve relations simultaneously with all of them. And the 92 consensus, namely One China, respective interpretations, is the key to the success of my grand strategy. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you, President Ma, for that comprehensive and very thoughtful address. You actually answered the question that I was going to ask, so I'm going to surprise you with another one, but I'm sure you can handle it because it's about your birthplace, Hong Kong. And I wonder, what are your observations about the situation in Hong Kong today, and are there any implications for Taiwan?
Well, I'm sure you know that I was born in Hong Kong. My parents actually came to Taiwan first, and then later on they went to Hong Kong, and I was born there. So quite a few friends from Hong Kong says, in business terms, I was made in Taiwan, but delivered in Hong Kong. and then re-export to Taiwan. So I do have a special affection for Hong Kong. And what happened in Hong Kong after 97 was my concern for many years. Ever since we improved relations with the mainland, our relation with Hong Kong also improved as a result, which is quite encouraging to us. But Hong Kong's democratic movement is also something I pay a lot of attention to. But although the one country, two system formula, which the mainland designed originally for Taiwan, was rejected by Taiwan, and they applied in Hong Kong, but they also have a lot of problems over there. So on the one hand, we certainly would see a more democratic Hong Kong, particularly which implement the promises of mainland Chinese leaders to Hong Kong, 港人治港. On the other hand, we also hope we could improve further our relationship with Hong Kong and share our experiences, many things. And so in the foreseeable future, we'll continue to be very concerned about Hong Kong's elections and whether democracy could be rooted in that part of the world. But I also noticed that 3 years ago in my National Day address, I said something that mainland China was very angry. I said Deng Xiaoping went to the South in 1992 to see the policy of open to the West, and he emphasized that they will let part of the people get rich first. In other words, that's the only way to change the economic landscape. I paraphrase now, he said, that why don't we let part of the people get democratic first? Well, I don't like that. They don't like that. But I think we in Taiwan, we certainly believe that if mainland China ever become attractive to Taiwan, they must do something in this regard. Freedom, democracy, human rights, and rule of law. Well, this is the lifestyle the people of Taiwan has been used to for many years. So in order to shorten the distance between the two sides of Taiwan Strait, this is a very important way.
Thank you. Doug, do you have a question?
Yes, I do. You've done a lot to struggle against diplomatic isolation and to fight a practical path forward, but there's also economic isolation. And we had a negotiation, now disrupted, of an agreement on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Mm-hmm. And that had a lot of benefit for people like ourselves and others who would be in that trading relationship, but might have isolated Taiwan from, and Taiwan's global encompassing companies would have had to compete with companies that had privileged trading relationships with each other, especially Japan and Korea, which are real competitors for some of your best firms. Now we've put, with the Trump administration, TPP has been put to one side. I hate to say dead, but I'll say maybe comatose or in a freezer. But in the meantime, do you see any scope for the U.S. and Taiwan to start forging their own bilateral trade agreement, free trade agreement?
Well, we now have no choice. I have, during my presidency, tried very hard to prepare our participation in the second round of negotiation in DPP, but it's TPP, but they're all gone. But of course, we still want to liberalize our trade relationship with the United States for sure. So we have to, first of all, utilize the TIFA, the Trade and Investment Agreement Framework, which was concluded in 1994, but certainly want to expand that to cover other aspects as well. I'm sure you're aware that in the last couple of years, the U.S. has become our number two trading partner, surpassing that of Japan, and we have become your number nine trading partner, again, surpassing that of Saudi Arabia and India. So even without a FTA type of agreement, through our efforts, we could really contribute to the enhancement of trade relations. But if we had one, I think we can do even better.
Thank you very much. We have about a half an hour for questions. And once I call on you, wait for the microphone. It will be in your hands in just a little bit. And say who you are and your affiliation, and then keep your question short. So I think I saw Deng Huiyu's hand first. China Review, Zhenguo Pinglun.
Thank you so much. My name is Deng Huiyu with China Review News Agency of Hong Kong. And thank you very much for talking to us today. And I still remember 10 years ago, you make a remark in AEI. I also participated in that.
No, 11 years ago.
Oh, 11 years ago. Very nice to meet you again here. My question is, yesterday the director of Tao, Zhang Zijun, said in Beijing that at the end of the road of Taiwan independence is the unification. So what's your react to that? Secondly, you have experience of meeting with President Xi Jinping, and I believe you also have an observation of his policy toward Taiwan. What's your view of him? How do you feel about him? Do you have any opportunity to meet with him again in the next several years? Thank you very much.
That's about six questions. So.
You want me to answer right now?
Yeah.
Okay, first of all, I think he just wanted to show that Tai do is something that should not be done. Otherwise, it could mean war or something. But it's actually, even in Taiwan today, even DPP was not very prudent and not to go too far. I'm sure you have noticed that recently when TPP, in an effort to lower down the threshold for referendum, Gong Tou Fa, they suddenly stopped. Why? Because some of their members said we could include in the items, in the topics for referendum, well, the national territory of Republic of China. If somebody says that our territory are limited only to Taiwan, Pescadores, Kinmen, and Mazu, that means that we will forget about our constitutional territory of the mainland. It could be a substantive independence. So they themselves decided to stop. It's a little bit funny that the KMT says, go ahead, do it. You have said that so many, many years. Why don't you do it now? They don't want to do it. They know it's very, very dangerous. So I'm sure that would not happen because, as I said, what the people who support Taidu for so many years want to, Taiwanren Chu Tou Tian, okay? But this has already been accomplished, right? On the other hand, it's not a minority rule. It's a majority rule. We now elect our own president, elect our own parliament, run our own business according to our own law. This is total, autonomy. The only difference is that we do not have a Republic of Taiwan. But do we really need that? 7 years ago, I was interviewed by Christiana Amanpour of CNN, the telecommunication interview in Taiwan. The first question she raised is that, Mr. Ma, why don't you just declare independence? Taiwan's independence. I said, Christiana, have you ever heard a country declaring independence twice? we are already a sovereign state back in 1912. So we're a Republican. We don't have to do it again. And I particularly, even if somebody wants to do that, nobody will recognize us. So that's what I'm saying. It's not going to succeed. So I think Mr. Zhang's statement primarily just tried to scare some people who did not understand the issue. But in Taiwan, I'm sure many people understand. They won't do that. Okay. Another one is, what is that?
Xi Jinping.
Oh, Ma Xihui. Will be Ma Xihui in the future? Well, I don't know, because it depends on a lot of things. But when we said goodbye in Singapore after the banquet, she said, "Hou hui you qi."
Okay, my colleague Ken Lieberthal.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. President, for your very wide-ranging, balanced, and substantive remarks. You did a great deal as president to increase not only communications across the strait, but also the capacity of companies to operate on both sides. And we're now in an era when the U.S. President is contemplating imposing a variety of kinds of measures to punish, in his terms, punish the mainland for not fulfilling the what he sees as his obligations for fair trade with the United States. Do you have a sense of, if these measures are taken, to what extent they will impact Taiwan's companies and Taiwan's economy? Thank you.
Well, this is a very good question. As I just mentioned, thank God that President Trump, you know, went back to the traditional China policy of the United States. And actually, our efforts to improve relations with the mainland actually has complementary to that. That is why, as I mentioned, Susan Thornton, the principal deputy secretary, deputy assistant secretary of state, says the reason why U.S.-Taiwan relations become so good, I think our handling of cross relations is one very important reason. But if the cornerstone of U.S.-China relations was removed, I think we would not benefit with that relationship. That is why we think it's good to return to the normal mode of operation. And I think we probably have to wait for a little while to see whether all those things President Trump said during his campaign or in the last couple of months will really take place. But it has to be very careful because this is relationship involves not just U.S. and mainland China, but also the surrounding countries.
But if, for example, we increase tariffs on goods made in China, we would affect Taiwan companies,
of
right,
course,
because
of course.
Supply chains.
Of course. Then you will punish your consumer.
Yeah.
You know, that's one
and
thing.
Our friends.
Yeah.
The young man right here in the aisle.
Thank you very much, Director Bush. My name is Gajin Yang. I'm a reporter for Phoenix Satellite Television of Hong Kong. Mr. Ma, in your speech, you talked about a bridge across the Taiwan Strait that anyone can anyone can cross as long as they follow the traffic rules. Can you reiterate once again what are specifically the traffic rules that you talked about? Thank you very much.
You talked about in your speech
a bridge across the Taiwan Strait, then anyone can use it to cross for communication, but one has to follow the traffic rules.
But the across the Taiwan Strait, there's a bridge, but there are traffic rules for crossing the bridge. And
well,
what are those rules?
Well, 92 consensus.
Okay. Right here?
Easy.
Hi, Mr. Ma, Chen Weihua, China Daily. In New York, you talked about only two options for Taiwan, one status quo, one reunification. So could you tell us what's the scenario of unification you have thought in your mind? I mean, just one more thing, that post-World War II, Vietnam reunified, Germany reunified, Korea maybe one day. And what will happen if China becomes the last country, I mean, nation to be, you know, still remain divided, or what will change the thinking of the Chinese people? Thank you.
First of all, my views about unification and independence remains unchanged compared to what I said in 2008. I said no unification talks during my presidency, and I do not support Taiwan independence, and well, I still hold that view. But on the issue, a long-term view of unification, I think it has to be done under the Republic of China Constitution by the 23 million people of Taiwan. So, but if conditions are not right, are not ripe, well, our people can always choose maintaining the status quo. So this is actually what happened now. Well, the Mainland Affairs Council in Taiwan have conducted more than 20 opinion polls in the last 10 years. Most people support maintaining the status quo. Well, but one day, if mainland China is able to provide something that attracts the attention of Taiwan people, which is
may be possible, then probably people will think that with time we could talk. But at the moment, such conditions are non-existent yet. So I think Mr. Bush once said, people in Taiwan, the government in Taiwan, should not let mainland China feel that unification, well, is
impossible.
Impossible. I agree. That is why I said, at the moment, we are not in a position to talk about it because there are so many things that still divide us. So we need a lot of efforts to draw closer the minds of our people. That should be done. That is why I try very hard to to invite mainland students to come to Taiwan so that young people can make friends at early stage of their life in order to bring closer the two sides together. This takes a lot of time. After all, the two societies are very, very different. But they are coming closer compared to 30 years ago, 50 years ago. So this is good, and we should continue doing that.
The gentleman in the red jacket in the back. Thank you.
Gregory Ho from Radio Free Asia. President Ma, welcome to town. I remember 20 years ago when you visited Hong Kong as a Taipei City Mayor, people loved you since you were born in Hong Kong. They see you as the son of Hong Kong. Of course, you're also the son of Taiwan. Since this year is the 20 years of Hong Kong's handover or changeover, do you see Hong Kong getting better compared with 20 years ago when you visit on those good old days or bad old days? Do you see any changes? Is it Hong Kong changing better or worse? Second question is, Hong Kong is going to elect, so-called, or select its own chief executive on March the 26th. Which candidate you will see has more potential? Thank you.
Well, I don't think I'm in a position to express my views on the candidates. Well, whether Hong Kong is becoming better or not, I think I'm not the most authoritative person to say that. Here you have one. But whatever, it, good or bad, it really depends on the feeling of the Hong Kong people. They are the master of their own destiny, so they should express their views whether it turned out better or not. Certainly, we hope Hong Kong will become better.
Okay. The young man here? Coming around.
Thank you so much for your talk. My name is Alex. I'm a Fulbright student here at GW, studying for a master's in public policy. You know, you're head of an unrecognized state, a problem very close to the heart of my country, Russia. my question is related to the things that probably the president-elect has caused by his recent interactions with the Taiwanese leader. A lot of people in academic circles, in international relations circles, immediately expressed their concern about instability. You know, there's vibrations, oh my God, and so on and so forth. But, you know, I certainly, like, as I don't think stability is a value in itself. I think if we have differences, we need to talk them over. I think frequent shakeups are not necessarily a bad thing. They may actually make us stronger as people, make society stronger, make country stronger. My question is, through your terms as president, have there been some things that you think were swept under the rug that you think you should have or could have dealt with, but there was no opening for that, and you know, there was probably a concern that it may stir this imbalance and so on and so forth and attract too much attention. Thank you.
Are you saying that whether we are transparent enough?
No. Were there things that you would have liked to accomplish, but you didn't have an opportunity or circumstances to?
Of course, in 8 years, you wouldn't be able to do very much. But at least, as I said, I want to create a society which is free, just, and prosperous. I think, by and large, I have achieved that goal. But because of the world economic situation, we were not able to even get better. On the other hand, the other two objectives, one is to maintain peace and prosperity across Taiwan Strait. That I have done. although we need to do more. But looking at the Chinese history, you understand that from separation to unification or unification to separation usually takes decades or sometimes more than 100 years. We don't really have to wait that long. But the key of the question is the two sides must have something in common in order to become reunified. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense. So it's not completed yet. On the international arena, certainly we have a much more friendly international environment than it is before. Again, there is still more to be done. Yeah.
The woman in the second row here.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. President. My name is Rosemary Segero. I'm a president of a company called Segero's International Group. We focus on manufacturing and innovation. Thank you so much for your presentation. You talked about Nigeria and Central Africa. I come from Kenya, though I'm an American here. What relation do you see a better relationship with African countries as a former president and as Taiwan, looking at trade and other issues related to politics and being a president, that's one. How did you look at women and how did you respect women or what work did you see women do better in your presidency and what could you say to the world about Taiwan women and the world women? Thank you.
What's the role of women in your government and the contribution of women of Taiwan?
Well, what is the role of women? The role of women in our country, the president. And more than one-third of the national parliament and more than one-half of the examination yuan and the control yuan. So they have played increasingly active role in our public life. On the other hand, we still have some way to go because the pay of female and male still has a gap. So it's narrowing, you know, in the last couple of years. And we provide a variety of help to mother, to young babies in order to make their life easier. So I think, I'm sure you are aware, the United Nations publicized a... what is that, the index of...
global development?
Gender inequality. Gender inequality index, okay, GII. We lost our representation in the UN, so we couldn't be listed by UN. But we used the same formula with our statistics. We came out, we're within top five of the world in terms of quality, not inequality. So I think women has a lot of opportunities, of course, and increasing power, even in the family. So well, I can feel that in my family. So this is something we like to see, and they are now better educated than men in quite a lot of ways. So we have achieved as much as possible. As I said, one area we should work harder. Is still an equal pay in some area.
Taiwan and Africa?
Our relations, we used to have many African allies, particularly after the 1960s, but one by one, they were actually established ties with mainland China. So we only have now two countries, Swaziland and Burkina Faso. When I was president, we were four, now it's only two. But we continue to work with them, trying to not just improve relations, but really help the life of the people. For instance, in Burkina Faso, we provided a solar lamp for their family. They could be used for 4.5 hours, but they have to recharge at school. So using that lamp, actually, you will see more students want to go to school so that they could be recharged and go back home using that to do their homework. I actually went to the village to see their work. Unfortunately, they have to crawl in the ground and write their French lessons. I used my very broken French accent Combien de long voulez-vous avoir? How many lands do you want? They raise their hand and say, beaucoup, many. So we still are doing that, helping them. But I talked to the teachers at school. What change does the land bring to the education? The teacher says their monthly exams, they did much better. So this is something we'll continue to do. Help our friends over there, make them a better life.
The young man right here. You. Okay. Wait for the mic. It's coming.
Thank you, President Ma, for your remarks. My name is Jin Bojun. I'm a research associate at the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy, National University of Singapore. During your presidency, it seems like you have forged pretty good relationships with many ASEAN countries under the banner of viable diplomacy. But given the current stalemate, as you mentioned in your address, how would you assess the President Tsai's new southbound policy, the prospect of this policy, Taiwan's future relationship with ASEAN countries? Thank you very much.
Well, certainly we support better relations with Southeast Asian countries. So the sort of southward policy actually occurred many years ago. Let me just give you an example. Our relations with Malaysia. Their students in the past came to Taiwan to study, but their diploma were not recognized for so many, many years. But in 2012, we concluded an agreement with Malaysia, which will mutually recognize each other's diploma. So the student from Malaysia to Taiwan rose from 3,000 a year to 7,000. We're very happy so that we can have better relations with Malaysia, beginning with their young people. So we continue to do that. And we do that also to Vietnam, to Thailand, to India, and to Indonesia. You know, they send their college lecturers to Taiwan to pursue a master's degree and vocational education. So we certainly like to make Taiwan a higher education center in this part of the world. And, before I took office, we have only about 30,000 students from abroad. But now it's 110,000. So there are quite a few. And we continue to do that because as a result of low birth rate, we have many places in universities open to students from outside.
Thank you. The bearded gentleman toward the back.
Mr. President, thank you very much for your remarks. I'm Julian Baum. I was based in Taipei as a journalist before. You mentioned in your remarks that the opposition had swept both the presidency and the legislature last year, and I spent a good deal of time in Taiwan last year, both before and during and after the election. And there was a perception among a lot of supporters of the opposition party that you and your government had moved too far too fast on cross-strait relations. And that was one of the reasons for the KMT's defeat last year. And it also seems to be an issue currently within your current party leadership, a very bitter dispute over what the future of the KMT's policies with China should be. Could you comment on that and whether or not you agree with some of this analysis? Thank you very much.
First of all, it has been reported or discussed in Western press that the KMT's setback in the elections were due to the Mandarin policy. I totally disagree, because actually it brought to Taiwan many benefits, and it's not unevenly distributed. People like to say, well, all the benefit that we gain from Mainland China were actually grabbed by large business. It's not the case in Taiwan, because as you know, in Taiwan, 98% of business and small and medium-sized business, they are very active, and they have a lot of investment in China and in the trade. So our relation with mainland China, by and large, is good for Taiwan. And I think our election failure were other reasons. For the local elections in 2014, the basic problem is the food safety. Food safety is a rampant problem over there. So that caused our failure. But in the presidential and legislative elections, there's something to do. Something had to do with the domestic problems of the party, the choice of candidates and all that. So you can see that a lot of people just didn't go to vote. So I'm very confident that the situation will be changed gradually by May, when a new chairman will be elected for the party. If we can support he or she to continue the reforms, I think gradually we'll come back. Okay. Thank you.
The woman on the aisle in the middle, yeah.
Thank you. I'm Shihoko Goto with the Wilson Center. Continuing with the theme of elections, one of the biggest issues that mobilized voters to the polls was concerns about the economy. Economic growth in Taiwan still remains a challenge, but short of issuing more shopping vouchers to boost domestic demand, what public policies can the current administration pursue to enhance domestic demand? And also, what kind of policies could be pursued to enhance Taiwan's competitiveness from within its borders? Thank you.
Well, let me just briefly answer your question about what we can use mainland China to enhance Taiwan's competitiveness. Taiwan has a lot of exports for sure, but we are not very strong in export of the service industry. So when we signed a trading service agreement with the mainland, we hope we could use the mainland market to develop our own competitiveness in the service industry export. Actually, at the time, mainland China also had that policy to develop their own service industry. So this is a good opportunity, but unfortunately, the agreement was signed but was not passed by our legislative yuan. And even today, 4 years after it was concluded and signed, we're still doing nothing. And I remember during the time, Asian Wall Street Journal carries an editorial that says, Taiwan leaves itself behind. Unfortunately, they had a lot of misunderstanding about our trade with the mainland. It actually is in our interest, and we didn't really sacrifice our sovereignty to get a trading opportunity. It's not the case. I'm sure you have heard a lot about Ma Ying-jeou, Qingzhong Mai Tai. It's just not the case. And if I did that, why does my successor want to maintain the status quo? Think about that.
We have come to the end of our time, which is unfortunate, because we could keep talking for a long time, but I think we need to give you a little bit of a rest and keep you on schedule. Before we leave, I'd like to acknowledge a couple of people, thank a few people. I'd like to first acknowledge Jim Moriarty, the chairman of the American Institute in Taiwan. An organization that I'm a bit familiar with. And then my old friend, Ambassador Shen Lushun, who's a former TECRO representative here in Washington, D.C. I'd like to thank Doug Paul for being my co-host. I'd please convey to your colleague, Alex Taylor, our thanks for his work to support this. I would like to thank my colleague, Maeve Whelan-Wiest, for all her hard work. Before the last thank you, I have a request, and that is you remain in your seats while President Ma leaves the auditorium. So finally, please join me in thanking the former President of the Republic of China, Dr. Ma Ying-jeou.